this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word, and today my guest is Bill Wish. Hello, Bill. How are you?
Great, Scott. Thanks for asking me to be part of this program.
Well, I'm glad that you're here, and I'm glad you're all the way from New Jersey, so you don't get out of state very much nowadays.
New Jersey, huh? Yeah, good old New Jersey. You know, I escaped the air and the clear blue water, health water. You know, no, it's
The Jersey Shore.
Actually, a very good state. A lot of people don't realize how much is in New Jersey. That really is. Once you get out of the, you know, metropolitan area, it's really pretty much like middle America. You know, it's flat, you know, farming, the whole bit.
Well, this is the Garden State.
Garden State, lots of gardens, yeah.
Yeah, and they have a lot of blueberries, strawberries, a lot of...
Right, the berries. Yeah. The berries are big, a lot of fruit farms, things like that. And, of course, you know, certain things, some strawberries and all that. You're absolutely right.
Now, where about in New Jersey do you live?
Right now I live in Hackettstown, New Jersey, which is out west toward the Delaware Water Gap. Mm-hmm. Everybody says, where is it close to? I say, well, that's close to itself, because that's the city that everybody says it's where you're close to. But it has some merit because it's the hometown of the Mars Company, you know. M&M.
Oh,
They have their headquarters.
Mars Chocolate, yeah.
Mars Chocolate right in Hackettstown, New Jersey. If you look at the bar, Mars, it says Hackettstown, New Jersey right on there. Yeah.
Interesting.
M&M's, yeah.
Now, you had moved there. You were closer to New York City at one time.
In Bergen County. Bergen County was right across the Hudson from New York City. And lived there all my life. Was born in Bergenfield and lived in Montvale when I got married, which is in the northern part of Bergen County. And then decided to move out west when we had our children, and out west New Jersey, and about an hour and a half away. So it's still in the metropolitan area, but it's a little removed, but still a little bit more less city. It's more rural, more countrified. When we moved out, when I first moved out there about 26 years ago, they had the cow still there and all, but now it's built up a lot too, you know. But it was still pretty rural, and it still is compared to the brick and mortar, you know.
Now you're out on the lecture tour then right now, talking about Slidini, and it's kind of a redo, if you will, from your lecture tour back in the 70s,
right?
In which you were out not just lecturing on Slidini's stuff, but also helping to market his books that Tannens had published at the time.
Right.
So let's go back in history just a little bit as far as when you had first, I guess, met Slidini and started to take your lessons from him, and how did that come about?
I was I saw Slidini at a performance. And fell
in New York City?
We had it for our banquet, you know.
The Magicians.
We had it for our SAM banquet in September of 1973. And I said, oh, this guy, I've always heard about him. He's a legend.
And you thought he was dead. I
thought he was dead. I didn't know. I was new to magic. I had only been magician for a couple of years at that time. And so I thought this guy Slidini was up there with Cardini and Blackstone and, you know, all these... all these great magicians I had read about in the Tannen catalog. That was my thing, at the Tannen catalog. So when I went through that catalog, I saw all these great names, and a lot of them I could kind of sense that they were still alive. But for the most part, some of them, I put Slidini for some unknown reason in that category of being a dead magician. And, you know, when you think of someone as being dead for years, a couple of years, and then you hear from one of your members of the club say, we're going to have Slidini this year at our banquet. I said, holy mackerel. It should be some sight to see. No, but I freaked out. I said, this is going to be great to see this guy's. And I did have his Encores book. I had purchased his Slidini Encores book. It was the Nathanson book that came out. Great book. And but trying to get anything out of that book would be ridiculously difficult. You can't get it. But I found the guy, just to look at him was intriguing, to see this little guy. He just looked like the kind. And then, of course, I saw the Stars of Magic. And saw this. He just looked like the kind of guy that fooled it.
And he would have been in his 50s about then?
That was in 1973. So he was 73. So whatever year whatever year it was that in the 1900s, that's how old he was. So whenever, you know, the listeners here have seen him, if some of you have seen him, go back to the year that you saw him, and that's how old he was, 58, 69, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I only started with him in 73, so he was already 73 years old. And that was it. So any year after that. So I didn't have a whole lot of time with him, but for those few years I spent a lot of time. But when I saw him perform at the banquet, I fell in love with his magic. And then that was in September. In November, I heard that they were going to have a testimonial in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Slidini was going to have a testimony. I said, oh, my gosh, I got to go to that. So sure enough, my wife and I went in and we got tickets. And I knew every magician in the world would be in New York City that day. That was a big deal. And they were. There were a lot. It was a place called the Netherlands Club as part of Rockefeller Center. There was a little club nestled in one of those buildings. And they had sent out, you know, little invitations. And you pay, you know, I think it was $25, whatever. This is going to be a Slidini testimonial. So I was the first one to get tickets, I think. I really was anxious. This has been just a couple of months since I had seen him, you know, for the first time at the banquet. So, you know, I went, and I was all excited because I figured, I've been in magic now a couple of years. I've been going to the meetings. We had some pretty good, you know, teachers or magicians in our club. Connie Bush and Frank Walsh was a good friend. He was Audley Walsh's brother. Mm-hmm. And he had tremendous stories about Scarney and all the old-timers that he had known. And, you know, it was fascinating listening to these guys. And so it was an older club, but the big person in our club was Herb Zarrow, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was in awe of this guy. So I said, I'm going to ask Herb Zarrow if he'll give me lessons. Finally, and I knew he was going to be at the banquet because he was a good friend of Slidini's. So I went to the banquet with my wife, and we had another couple. There was Herb, right? So the whole thing takes place, and Slidini had one of his students come up, and Phil Verrecchio, his name is. I talked to him on the phone once. He's a lawyer in Las Vegas, and he was a really good student of Slidini. He did the Balls to the Box that night as a little tribute, and that was fun. And everybody would come and give a little roast, you know. Some of the guys would tell a little joke here, but there was about 140, 150 people there. It was a big crowd.
Yeah.
Every magician you could think of was there from New York. So I was in awe, you know. So I go, I feel, all right, now's my big chance. The whole thing is over, right? And it's kind of everybody's winding down and going home. And so I'm standing, I'm saying, I'm going to go over to Herb and ask him. So I said, hey, Herb, could you do me a big favor and teach me, could you give me some lessons? So he lived in Fairlawn. I lived in Bergenfield at the time, which is maybe about, you know, 10 miles. So it wasn't any big deal. He said, I was hoping, please say yes, you know. He said, don't ask me. And he had this high-pitched voice. Don't ask me. Ask him. And I said, my first thought was, you're nuts. I mean, I don't want to study with Slidini. I'm not, you know, no, I'm not up to that level. He said, no, study with him. So I went over to Slidini, and strangely enough, there was nobody talking to him at that moment. He was just sitting there on the dais. I walked over to him, and I'll never forget, nervous. And I said, would you be able to teach me? I was really nervous.
Yeah.
And he said, sure, call me up. And he reaches in his pocket, takes out a business card, and gives it to me. Call me up on Monday. This was on a Saturday night. Call me up on Monday. So I said, okay. And that was it. I called him up on Monday, and that was November. And I started with him in December.
Now, tell me this. I know that the cost of living certainly has changed over the last 40 years or so, but what did lessons cost from Slidini?
Okay. It's an interesting thing because if you look back in the early 1970s, he knew he was doing you a favor, because when you took a lesson from him, the real value with that lesson was the fact that you had him, but it was usually for the amount of time. He didn't care so much about the time. He didn't care about the time. He didn't care if it was 3 hours or 2 hours or 4 hours. So many of the lessons would go 3-4 hours, or maybe mm-hmm. even longer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I study with him in the afternoon, so it always would come to an end around 5:30 or 6. But sometimes I understand at night you'd go there and he'd have dinner and, you know, spaghetti and meatballs, and we'd sit there all night.
He said he was a late night guy.
He was a late night guy, and he'd have people stop by because he was only a block away from Broadway, and Tannen's was right up the street. So everybody that came into New York City would come to Tony's. You know, I mean, he had parties there with people you could, oh my gosh, I wish I had, I was a fly on the wall for some of those. Every magician in the world came through his place because he was there all those years. A little rent control apartment, you know, and he didn't pay a whole lot of money. It was on the ground floor. And so
how much did it cost for his lessons?
So
you said
the lessons,
it didn't
matter. $25.
Whether it took 3 hours or 2 hours or whatever.
But that's the key. If you look back and say $25, because in those days gas was about 25 cents a gallon.
A gallon, right.
So, all right, $25 was a decent amount of money.
Yeah.
But then again, you had to park. You had to go into New York. You had to park and all this other stuff. But it wasn't a big deal. But it was well worth it. $25 was nothing. I expected it to be more.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he raised it after about a year or so to $35.
Yeah.
But it was still always a bargain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always felt like I was ripping him off in a way.
Yeah.
But it's cute. One day I gave him a check. And he went, oh, no, no check. He wanted cash all the way, you know.
Now, whenever that you do get a lesson from Slidini, or did get one, did he have something in mind that he wanted to teach, or did you come saying, I want to know this about something that you do? I mean, I know that you do helicopter car. Teach me helicopter car. Or do you, or did he say, here's something that I want to teach you? You know,
that's a good question. What happened was, when I first went to him, the first thing he said to me was, first lesson, what do you want to learn? And I said, well, I saw you. He remembered me a little because I, you know, and I said, from the banquet also, because I had had him sign my book and everything.
Yeah.
It's a funny story about that, too, which, remember I told you I had the Encores book?
Yeah.
So I was like, here I thought the guy had been, he was dead for years. So I find out he's going to be giving, doing the closing our show. And he was still, at that time he was only 73, so he was a pretty spry guy.
Yeah.
And so I go there, and I got there real early because I had my book and I wanted to have it signed. I said, I'm going to have Slidini sign my book. So I get there, and the people, you know, are taking the tickets. They're just about getting started themselves. Nobody else was there. And I said, is he here yet, to them? They said, yeah, he's in the back. I said, really? So I hear this tapping.
Yeah.
Like something like a hammer hitting a nail, right? I go in the back, and it was in a place... It was called the Rustic Lodge on Route 46 in Elmwood Park. I don't think it's there now. It turned into a Chinese restaurant. I don't even know if it's still there. But when we had it, it was called the Rustic Lodge. It was really and they had a dais. You know, they have like a wrought iron fence, mm-hmm. and then they have a table, and they have the wedding parties and all this stuff.
Oh, sure.
It's one of those kind of places.
Okay.
In the back room, they had this thing. But that's what we would use as a stage. So they had this wrought iron fence up there. And every year, we did it for years. And we had a lot of big acts, Milburn Christopher. I mean, everybody. But they didn't mind. The wrought iron fence was there as part of the little dais.
Yeah.
But Slidini, so we had a little makeshift thing in the side with a curtain over it that we had put up just for, you know, to get the head ready. So I wasn't involved, but they had set up all that. And so I hear this little tapping. So I go over to it, and I very gently part. And this is my first glimpse of the man alive, right? The man I thought was dead. This is September 7th, as a matter of fact. So I pull a curtain by, and I see this little man with a white shirt and a tie on. His glasses, like one of these little shoemakers, you know.
Yeah.
But his little glasses down to the tip of his nose, because he did wear glasses when he did close-up work. And he turned around and looked at me. And in his mouth, he had a couple of nails, right? Like a shoemaker would have. And I remember the look on that man's face. It could scare you to death, right? And I remember the look on his face, and I said, Mr. Slidini, would you sign my book? And you get that urge, you get that feeling that you know you're just completely, you know.
That's the wrong question at the wrong time.
Absolutely wrong question at the wrong time. You feel like you just, you know, completely, you know, it took away his fast. Later. He looks at him, later, like that. You know?
Got a mouthful of nails.
Yeah, and his look on his face, like this right in. If you look at his picture, you can see how he could have that look if he really gave you that grimace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it scared the daylights out of me. So I said, okay, thank you. I walked away. I was really kind of. So I said, wow, I talked to him, but it wasn't too friendly. You know? I felt like
bad first
impression. That's the last thing he's ever going to do. Hopefully, he said later, so I said, okay, I'll get it signed. So I didn't think much of it. But then we had Max Landano on that show. That was a great show. Oh, no, Tony Cordero. Tony Cordero did a great act. You know, Tony was the Doves and all that stuff. He was a great magician. And then we had Slidini. And he came on and just blew everybody. I mean, he did the knots, you know, a beautiful routine with the knots and the glasses and stuff. So I said to him, after it's all over, I went back, and of course everybody was going back, having him sign something, and of course I brought my book back, and he signed it, and that was, again, in September, and then November is when I went to the testimonial, so I don't know if you remember, I was the guy that just interrupted and put in, but here's the funny story I'm building up to it. One of the people in the club, Paul Zevin, his name was, really a good magician, very good magician, actually. And he knew Slidini's work, and I think he was even the one that picked up Slidini and had him stay at his house. But Slidini got to the place, and there was no wooden chairs. It was all, I forget what chairs they had, but it was one of those places where they had just, you know, a certain type of chair, and I don't know if they were metal or not, but he couldn't use it for his act, because he had to have the ring on the back.
On the back, right.
So what turned was, he said, Paul, I need a chair with a wooden chair. Do you have a wooden chair at home? So Paul gets in his car and drives. He lived close by. He drives a little ways home, gets he just had gotten his new, and he always told this story, this new dining room set. I mean, of course, it was a very expensive dining room set. His wife had no idea what was going on. So he needs a chair. So he put the chair in his car and brought it back. So here he is in the back, pumping holes in the back of his chair.
Brand new chair.
He didn't care. He didn't care. He just put it in and pat, tap, tap, tap. There's the little nail in there. And, of course, Paul freaked out when he heard about it. But Paul got a kick out of it because he said, hey, it's like the old Mellini story. He said, you know,
exactly.
When you stabbed the car, you know, what about the table? You ruined it. He said, yeah, but the Mellini is the one that ruined it.
Table. That's right. That's exactly
I have ruined your table.
You could tell him it was Mellini that ruined
and
your
And he always
table,
told that story. And I saw the chair later on. It was funny because I went to his house a few times. So that was always a funny story. So that's the way Slidini was, very particular. And so that's the first time I really had a run-in with him. But I thought you'd get a kick out of that story.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
So I was asking then as far as when he would give you a lesson, that would he have something in mind or would you have come with something in mind that you
wanted? See, I keep the train of thought.
That's okay.
So I said to him, he said, what do you want to learn? I said, well, I really would love to learn the knots because I loved watching the knots when you did them at the banquet. He said, you like the knots. He said, because a lot of times people come here, they want to study a trick or they want to learn a routine, and then they, you know, that's all they want to learn. Or they want to just take a lesson, you know, because he gave a lot of lessons at conventions, too. I mean, he just people would, he wouldn't even leave his room half the time. He would just be in his room giving lessons because people would sign up just to take 1 hour lesson with him, just to say they took a lesson. So he would give many lessons, and he'd make extra money.
Sure.
So I always got a kick out of that. So, but he says, what do you want to learn? I said, I want to learn everything. But I really want to learn a knot.
Let's start at the knots.
Yeah. So he says, you want to learn everything? Yeah. Well, you come at the right place, he says. And he laughed at you. He says, well, we started with the coin. And he goes over to this armoire. He had on his thing, opened it up, and he takes out this little bag and throws it on the table. He said, we started with the coins. So he knew if I was, because he knew I was really interested and I was going to stay. He did qualify. He did say, you really want to learn everything? I said, yeah, everything you can show me. I'm not that versatile at magic. I only started a couple of years ago. Would you be able to show me everything you can? I would love to, and I'll practice. Really, I was really, you know, and see, I was only, what, 30 at the time, for 29, 30 at the time. Well, actually, it was 27, 28, so I was still pretty young. And so he knew I was anxious, and so he said, all right. And then we started with the coins, and we spent, I'll never forget, that was the most fantastic time. It was 1973 going into 74, and then 75, and into 76. And then in 1976, one lesson. By that time, I had worked on a lot. Here's an interesting story. He never would let anybody videotape, obviously. Videotapes were starting to come out then in the beginning of the 70s with Betamax.
Betamax, right.
But I asked him, because I would have rented a camera. And pretty, I said, would you mind if I brought in and videotaped? No videotapes. I don't let anybody videotape. How about audio tapes? No, nobody. I don't let anybody audio tape. You listen, you learn, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, but he would let you bring in the audio tape to tape a song. That he, like, for example, if he was teaching the Balls to the Box, he used to use Yesterday, which was, you know, the Beatles
song. Mm-hmm.
And he had a really nice version, you know, with a very instrumental.
Yeah.
But again, it was, you could tell he had this on his tape. He owned reel-to-reel tape. It was a cassette tape, but it was like, you know, cracky. He got it off a record. But it was just, you know, him. Something to listen to, and he said, this is a good song, you take it this home and you practice with this. It's okay. It's something, you know, so you can get it, you know, something that's a three beat, a waltz or something, he'll tell you what to do. But I'll give you the song if you want. Okay. So I brought in the tape recorder. And I had one of those tape recorders that, you know, when you have a tape and it runs out, it pops up,
and turn it
makes
over
a
the
noise.
Side. Yep.
They have to turn it over. So I had one of those. So sure enough, I bring it and I put it in. And started tape the music. You know, okay, so then I put it down and I said, I'm not going to shut it off.
Yeah.
I'm going to be real cutesy. So I put it down on the floor in my briefcase and I left it on. And everything was all right because then he got up and went out and got a cup of coffee or whatever it was. In fact, I think I even turned it over.
Yeah.
But it was only a 30-minute tape, so, you know, 30 minutes on each side or whatever it was. So I turned it over. And I, oh, I really got, you know. And I did it and I said, you know, that's pretty cool because in the mornings at that time, I was studying with a fellow by the name of Max Landano. And Max Landano was a great magician, stand-up magician. He did the thread, the gypsy thread. It was one of the stars of magic, one of the new stars of magic, as a matter of fact, for Tannen. Very, very good magician. People don't know. He was from Columbia, South America. But boy, he tell you.
I remember the name.
Yeah, phenomenal magician. Great stand-up guy. And I had seen him at Tannen's Jubilee. So I wanted to study with him. So I studied with him in the morning for a couple hours, and then I would study at Tony's. So by the end of the day, my head was a complete, you know, jelly because I couldn't remember a lot of the stuff. So I'd have to go home, and before I forgot most of it, I'd write it all down.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
And I was up till 3 or 4 in the morning, and I had all those notes. I still have them, as a matter of fact. But it got to be much, so I figured, this is pretty cool, man. Because I asked Max, and Max didn't mind if I taped the lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Lady Sedona. So I said, this is cool. Maybe I can get away with this. You know? So I brought it in the next time, and I didn't show him the tape recorder. I just had it in my briefcase.
Yeah.
And I had the tape. But I graduated to the two-hour tapes. Now, I was going to be clever, you know. So I put the two-hour tape in, and went. And I think I got away with it once or twice, maybe once. And all of a sudden, one time, I forgot about it, and bam, the thing goes click. That was a loud click, too. And he goes, what? So what's it that? What's it that? You know, and he's right there, I mean, across the table. And then he looked around, and he saw my briefcase. And he gave me that look like, I didn't want him to feel bad, you know, like I was doing. So I said, look, I got to be honest with you. I've been taping the lesson, and I have a couple of tapes home. And the reason I'm doing it, I know you don't like it, is because I told him about Max.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I can't remember it all. And he looked at me and he says, you know, I never let anybody do it, but if you want to tape the lessons, you can tape. So from that point on, I always brought in a tape recorder. And he let all the other students do it from that point on, too.
It's a good idea.
So it was a good idea. It was kind of silly of him not to, but he just didn't. He always just wanted to make sure it was always a one-on-one thing. And, that was the way he was. He was very, very particular. And,
now, at some point then, he had completed the books,
yep.
And he had a deal then, apparently with Tannins,
yep.
That and Supreme had put out the same book or
Supreme,
something?
No, Supreme had a book by Louis Ganson called The Magic of Slidini, and it
okay.
came out in 1958, I believe it was. And that was the book. Don't forget, when Vernon and Slidini both went to Europe for the first time, they did their trips separately. They both went there pretty much unknown, you know. Even Vernon was unknown except for the, you know, New York City area and stuff. And they knew who he was. And then when they went over to Europe in those days, you were over in Europe. You took a boat or whatever, and you were there for a while.
Right.
And that's when Ganson did this Di Vernon book
sure.
of magic.
Right.
And then he did the, when Slidini went over, he did the Slidini book. But then they went on tour all over Europe, both of them. Different
mm-hmm.
times.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they came back, it was a big deal because they had these books now. And, of course, in those days, it was hard to promote yourself as a magician. So you almost, if you lined yourself up with a magic shop, like, for example, Magic Incorporated in Chicago, would sell certain things for Don Allen or somebody else. That
right.
would help Don Allen's name get out there.
Sure.
And I know Tannins did it with Derek Dingle. If it wasn't for Tannins, Derek Dingle wouldn't have gotten out there that fast.
Hmm.
Because they liked his material, and they would put it out there. And if Slidini, too. If Slidini's torn and restored newspaper and the rope thing he did with scissors and a few of the other things that they had, they were marketing of his. That, you know, of course he was with Stars of Magic too. That helped, and they were publishing that book. So all that helps to get your name out there. In those
mm-hmm.
days, that's what you had to do. So once he went over to Europe, Louis Ganson wrote that book, The Magic of Slidini, and that was it. That was the book. If anybody has, I mean, it's a great book. Even if you have the Carl Fulvis books, it's great. Just looking at it and reading I think Leslie Guest did the intro, if I'm not mistaken. It was a great intro. Talk about building up somebody. In fact, you know, and it was a great book. It had a lot of good, and had a lot of good pictures and photographs, and covered most of the basics. I would recommend anybody to read that book as well as the new books, because there's some things in there that, you know, just mm-hmm. the way they're described by Ganson. I liked it. So that's how the book,
so
The Magic of Slidini. So when
he worked with Lewis Ganson
yeah.
at the time. Okay.
And that was, yeah, that came out in, I think, 58, if I'm not mistaken. So then later on, Slidini always wanted, and then Nathanson came out with the book, the Encores book, Blanca Lopez, all those, they wanted to come out with another Slidini book. But again, it was just another book, and it had a lot of great stuff in it. But he always wanted to come out with a real definitive book with all his stuff in it. So, and I guess he talked to Tannins about it, and they said, or they asked him and said, would you like to do this, all your material, so we can get it out there? He said, yeah, but it's got to be this, it's got to be perfect. And they had the idea of having the one book with the pictures and one book with the text, and they did it. So that's what he did. And it's funny because there's so many stories. I don't have to spend, but I'm just saying, when he did this, I guess, I don't know how much time he spent on it, but Carl spent a lot of time on it, a lot of visits over with him. Carl's very particular. Carl never really talked to too many people. He stayed away. He did come to magic meetings and magic lectures, but he didn't talk to too many people. He was kind of like low-key.
Mm-hmm. Still is.
Still is. Yeah. He's very hard to talk
Carl
to.
Carl Fulvers, yeah.
Yeah, he's a piece of work, but I got to be, had a chance to spend a lot of time with him. We used to go to the Cedar Lane Diner, which is right, because he lived in Teaneck and I lived in Bergenfield. And we'd meet there at the diner, and he was just a normal guy, but he just loved magic. And of course, he was doing the Paul Bearer's Review, and mm-hmm. and he did a lot of the epilogues and all that stuff. So he was very well versed. And when he did a trick for you, boy, my gosh, he would fool you. I mean, he knew a lot of stuff, but
yeah.
he wasn't really a performer per se. But he didn't want to perform that much, but he could do it. And the interesting thing about it is, and I didn't realize this, but he was a very creative guy too, obviously. As he had the Paul Bearer's Review, I mean, most of that was fictitious people.
Oh, really?
Oh, so yeah. Most of that, 70% of it were all names he made up. And they were his tricks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of people, I think he told me once, he said, somebody wrote him a letter and said, how do I get in touch with so-and-so? I forget the name. He said, well, he won't take, I don't know how to get in touch with him myself. It's going to be hard. I want to write him a letter and ask him about that one trick. Well, I said, how about if you send me the letter and I'll, so he started this whole thing back and forth. But, he said about 75% of the people were fictitious names, you know, mm-hmm. that were in the Paul Bearer's. But that's the kind of guy he was. But so when he did something, my point was, when he did something, he did it really, you know. And I remember asking him after it was all over, I said, he looked at me, he said, I would never do this again. In a million years, I wouldn't do this again. It was mm-hmm. so much work, mm-hmm. so much work. And Slidini had the first set of pictures he didn't like, they had to redo all the pictures. And, you know,
did he take the photos, or they had a professional photographer?
No, the professional photographer. His name was Art Manfredi, and he was down in Bloomfield, New Jersey. And it was funny thing about it is we had Slidini for a lecture. At that time, I was the president of the IBM Ring 113, and I was looking for somebody to have a lecture. And so I said to Slidini, "Would you like to come up?" And she said, "Sure, you come over. And we have him at my house, and you could stay overnight, and then." Do the lecture, stay overnight, and then the next day he said, well, we can go down and do the pictures, and you can drive me down, because he didn't drive. So I said, sure, that'd be great. So he came over, did the lecture that Friday night. That was 135 people came to that lecture in the basement of a bank, and gave a phenomenal lecture. And then we went back to the apartment, my place, and it was a great evening. We had Mike Skinner there, and Jose De La Torre, Carl was there, Carl Fulvers, Herb Zarrow was there. You know, we had a good crowd of people in our little apartment. Here
right.
I am, a guy who knows very little, obviously. At that time, I'd only been in magic for a couple of years, but I was a student of his at that time. So, but I was thrilled, you know. So the next morning, we go to, and it was right next to the bank where we did the lectures, was right up the street. Right next to the bank was a Ramada Inn. And that was where they had a nice breakfast there. You could go and eat breakfast. So he said, you know what? We're going to go up there and have breakfast. Because we had had dinner the night before at our place, but my wife and I said, let's go up and have breakfast at Ramada Inn. So we go to the Ramada Inn, and you could see something was kind of bothering him a little bit. And then when he found out, he said, where was the lecture? The lecture was right here, right? And the bank is right there. You could see the bank from the Ramada Inn. Not many people know this story. So he says, I got to ask you to do me a favor. I said, what? You know, when I go to the lecture last night, and he knew he was going to stay at my place, he says, you know, I had to change your underwear into my case. And I didn't want the people to see it when I was selling the knots or the scarves and the thing. So I put it under the seat, in the couch, in the bottom, in the basement. I said, would you do me a favor down here? Sure, I'll go down there. My wife happened to have the key. Her father was the bank president, so that's how I got the basement of the bank, and it was a really nice, brand-new bank, too. So she had the key. So I said, okay, so we get in the car, and we drive around, we go to the... And I said, I'll be right out. So I go downstairs. Sure enough, here's Slidini's underwear underneath the... it was... and it's funny, because everybody said, does he wear boxers or briefs?
Yeah.
I'm kidding. I will never tell, you know. But... that's that little story I'll never give in. But I always thought that was the neatest thing, you know, a legend like that. Here I go from one extreme to the other, thinking the guy was dead to picking up his underwear from underneath things. But it was funny because that morning, we went to bed late, I guess 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, because we were talking and everybody was fiddling around. And so he said, we got to go to bed. So, okay, so he was out on the couch. We put him in the couch. outside in the living room, and my wife and I were in the bedroom. So the next morning, 8 o'clock, boom, 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 he's tapping on our door, 8 o'clock, come on, we got to go. Had his suit and jacket and everything on, his tie and white shirt.
Ready to go.
So that's when we went up to the place at 8:30, 9 o'clock. Then after that, we went down to, I drove him down myself to this guy, Art Manfredi's in Bloomfield, and that was the first session that he did the photos. And if you look in the book, you'll see the cigarette reincarnation where you take the cigarette and the tobacco and you roll a little paper ball up and you put it in and you poke the cigarette through. You do the that's my hands in there. He said to Carl, "Do you mind if I use?" So those you'll see this this crazy shirt with butterfly. In those days in the 70s, you had all these crazy shirts. So I had a butterfly motif. But you can see, and I was very honored to be part of that, the photographs in there. You know?
It's interesting, you know, I actually have an unfiltered cigarette of his. I was at a convention, I want to say it was maybe a TOM convention, and he was performing, and he had done the torn, restored cigarette, you know, through the hand like that.
Yep.
And then after he's finished, he got up and left, and I went over there, and I picked up the cigarettes off the floor and put
it
in an envelope.
Don't blame you one bit.
I mean, it means nothing to anybody. I mean, when I'm gone, my kids are going to say, "What is this cigarette?"
You tell them that's the day you quit smoking.
That's right.
That was the day. But my last cigarette.
That's right.
Was it a lucky strike?
It was a lucky strike. Yeah, not the lucky strike. So anyhow, going back then to the book itself, that there seemed to be a little bit of a problem between Supreme and Tannins
Supreme, once Tannins was sponsoring them, they were writing, they were paying for it, paying the bills to, I guess, Carl, whatever it was, you know, or produce it, publish it. So, so once they started coming out with him, Tony Spina told me that there were, you know, a couple, I guess one printing or whatever that was, a couple hundred copies. So it was called The Magic of Slidini and More. Mm-hmm. But, so the first copies were all numbered, Carl numbered them himself, and then Slidini would sign them and stuff. It was a big deal, and the covers were really nice, different, those books, the first edition books were a little different, very nice covers, and very different. It wasn't flat like now.
I think I have one of those.
You have one of those? Yeah, I have.
Because mine are numbered.
Yeah. You have a number on? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I got number 17. Mm-hmm. Carl gave me number 17, and I have it. And, of course, I had Slidini inscribe it and everything. But then what happened was Supreme found out that they called it The Magic of Slidini and More. And for some reason, Edwin got all upset and said, "We can't have that. That's an infringement of copyright. We have the name The Magic of Slidini. So you can't use that. You're going to have to use another title."
Mm-hmm.
So they had to come up with The Best of Slidini and More. So the books they had left, I think there were, forget how many he said, 120 copies, according to Tony Spina, came out with the Magic of Slidini and More. So if you have a copy of that, it's the, you know, that's the expensive one. That's the one that people would pay extra money for. I think you'd go for $200-$300, something like that on eBay. But it's the same book as they have now. It's just a different quality, you know, in first edition.
And so then he had a deal worked out with Tony, Tony Spina and Tony Slidini. The two Tonys had worked out something such that he was just going to be paid in kind with the books,
which I
basically
was surprised, and he was surprised about it too. He wasn't too thrilled about that. He really was.
I guess not after that. Heart and Soul.
He never really got paid for him, and he, you know, Carl was I think Carl was the first one that told me he never got paid.
Carl got paid, I assume.
I would imagine so,
but you don't know the story for sure.
I don't know anything. He never told me much about what he did. I never asked. But Slidini, because when he said to me, when you go around, maybe you can sell some books, and we could split the money. And I said, "I'm not going to split any money. If I sell any books, you're going to get all the money, because you're sending me on a tour. You're helping me go out there and lecture your material, and you're honoring me with that. So I'd be more than happy to sell the books." And at that time, we just loaded up as many as we could in the car, you know, and sold them right there. But they would usually be sold in a couple of lectures. I'd go out and do five or six or seven after the third lecture, because we had a small car at the time.
Well, people do now, of course, that they ship ahead.
They ship ahead.
Drop ship stuff. Well, so you didn't do that back then.
Didn't do that back then, and I just put a whole bunch in and sold them right there. Sold them on the spot. So, and then I would give him all the money.
Yeah.
And he loved that, because he made and I don't know if Tannins liked it too much, because they had to give him a lot of books. I think they should have paid him, but there was a lot of things that I kind of stuck up for him, because he was a particular kind of person, and whether he just liked certain things, whether he did or not, he did a thing for NBC once. I remember it was a Thanksgiving special. I'm sure, I know it's on tape. People have seen it. But I remember it was on. He said, I'm going to do the show, and I'm going to be on. And so I watched it at home. It was Thanksgiving. And I watched him. Then I called him on the phone that evening, and I said, boy, you were really good on the show. You know, like somebody would call up somebody and say, you did a great job. He said, I'm not happy with that. It was on a tape. They had it on a tape. They taped it. And he said they played it too fast or too slow. I forget what it was. I had the copies that I had. And he was convinced that they played it, the tape, too fast or too slow. He didn't like it at all.
Yeah.
So I was, what do you say? So I said, well, that's really a shame. He said, I wish if somebody would have told them. They made a mistake. So you know what I did? I said, well, it was NBC. And I said, I'm going to write a letter for you. So I wrote a letter to them and said, Slidini said that blah, blah, blah. And I never got an answer back, I don't think. But I think it impressed him that I would write the letter for him and complain. And
right.
say, I think that, you know, he was very disappointed that you guys evidently played the video. So that impressed him. And he was that way. I mean, if you did something, you know, I didn't do it for any payback. I just did it because I felt bad for him. Because I was expecting him when I called him up to say, oh, thank you, you know, great, you know, blah, blah. You did a really good job. It was really fun watching you. And he was complaining. It was funny. He was a cool guy.
Now, when did he die? When, 90?
91.
Yeah.
January 91. In fact, the 15th, he actually died, the 15th. And I think the wake was the 17th, if I'm not mistaken. And the reason I remembered that is because it was the exact same first day that Desert Storm started. That was the day that had the first explosions. But I remember going home from the wake that night and seeing on the news the explosions. You know, it was the Gulf War, and they were up to that point you hadn't seen too many explosions on TV.
That's true. I remember this.
Yeah, and that was the night that everybody came to the wake, and it was
Catholic.
It's funny. It was in a Catholic church. The funeral was the following day or the second day, whatever it was. But not many people came to that. A few people came to it.
To the wake or the funeral?
A lot of people came to the wake.
Okay.
Very few people came to the funeral.
Interesting.
A few people. Not many. It was a weekday, obviously. But still, I was surprised. But the funny thing about it is he never really talked much about his family. Nobody knew much about his family. He only talked about his sister all the time.
And he was never married.
Nobody knows. He could have been married down in, because he only came into this country from Argentina when he was 30. And there were a lot of stories about him being married. Now, I don't know why those stories started. You know,
and leaving his wife in Argentina.
Not necessarily leaving, or maybe not getting along with her. Maybe it didn't work out. There was some even stories I heard that he had children. And, you know, I don't know. Who knows? You know, I don't think so.
He never talked to you about it.
No. He never talked about anything with me except about his sister in Boston. And he would go visit his sister once in a while. So, you see, you could
Did
tell
you ever he meet her?
He didn't. No, I never met her.
I just wonder if she's his same size. You said he was like 5'3".
5'3", yeah. But he, and the reason I knew he was 5'3", I didn't measure him, but my wife was 5'2".
Okay.
And whenever he stood right next to her, I said, wow, he's 5'3".
Yeah.
So I knew how high he was. But he never talked about and I even said to him once about, I asked him a question about his family too, and he said, I don't talk about the family. I don't nothing to do with my family. And he never talked about his family at all. And the funny thing about it is, at the funeral, that's all the people that showed up with his family. He had like 40 people from his family come. His nephew
that lived in and around New York or came from
Argentina. Lived in Denville, which is close by. They lived all around New York City, Denville, and they had cousins and nieces and nephews his real name was Marucci, and his
Antonio Marucci.
Quintino is his first name, but the nephew was Carlo Marucci, and he came out of the woodwork, and you know, I don't want to say anything. You know, but I could see maybe a little bit why he didn't want to do his parents. Because they wanted to copyright his name right away.
Oh.
They wanted rights. If anything, anybody comes out with anything, we want to get, we have the rights to his name.
So they knew he was somebody within our community.
He was somebody who was important in magic. And the interesting thing about it, I know Gene Matsura, when he came out with the annotated Magic of Slidini, which is the Magic of Slidini by Ganson, but just with annotated notes that he had gotten from Slidini once the book came out. And Slidini said, oh, you know, they left a lot, because according to Gene, he said, they left a lot out, they didn't put certain things in, I wish I had done this. He said, well, why don't you tell me all the things you would like to have put in? He made notes, which was fantastic. So he made all the notes, and when time came, I guess he went to L&L, or L&L came to them, or whatever, and said, look, we'd like to do a reprint of it,
yeah,
and we could put all your notes in there. So that's what they did, and that's the annotated Magic of Slidini, which is a great book. But in the front of that, you'll see where Carlo Marucci, Gene was very nice. Actually, I know he would be more than, he said, Gene says right there, he says, Carlo Marucci owns the rights to Slidini's name. So he got permission. This is with permission. Anyway, but there's so many stories that we could go on and on and on about.
Well,
one time, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say that obviously there are so many that when you are asked what story comes to mind, there has to be something that would be one of your favorite stories about him.
Well, one of the stories, it's in that book, Emma Dye came out with a book, Yvonne, you know.
Yeah, Yvonne, yes, sure do.
He came out with a book last year or 2 years ago about the funny stories, strange stories.
Sure, yeah.
And I submitted this one to him. He loved it. He put it right in the book. It's in the book, but it's a great story, and it really happened. When he didn't have any car, so he would, you know, whoever student was in, he would have them be a roadie, a little driving around.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate to be that for a while, which was great because that's a learning experience. So I remember I was going to be taking him up to Connecticut, I think, to New Haven to do a show. So, I wasn't that far away because it was at nighttime, I remember. So it couldn't have been. I picked him up another time, but that's another different story. But it was at nighttime. I think I had to take him someplace to a meeting up in Westchester or something. I forget. So it was dark. It was around 6 o'clock at night, and it was raining like crazy. And I remember going, I had a little Volkswagen, I had a little beige Volkswagen, right? Mm-hmm. 73 Volkswagen Beetle. So it was a nice little car. So I'm driving into New York, and it's a one-way street going west on 45th Street, and he was between, you know, 8th and 9th Avenue. And I pull in, and I'm going down, and there's a light at the end of the block. Actually, it's 10th between 9th and 10th there. So 10th there, there's your light. And so here I pull up, and he's waiting. The plan was he was always going to wait outside.
Yeah.
And so he has his hat on with a brim. You know, he had a hat on and a overcoat, like a raincoat, but an overcoat. So you really, you know. So here's this little guy. It looks ominous to begin with, but nobody would see him. He wouldn't know, so it doesn't matter. He would just jump in the car and we'd take off. So wouldn't you know it, there's a car in front of me, and right in front of that car is another gray, beige Volkswagen. Now, he was used to my car, right?
Okay.
So you got to picture this. Okay. You got to picture this. So we're driving down the street. The light turns red, and it's about another maybe 100 feet to the end of it. So it was about 4 or 5 cars, and then this beige Volkswagen just stopped right there, and then another car, a little bit bigger car, and my car.
Yeah.
But it's back about maybe 25 feet. So I all of a sudden I see this guy dart out, you know,
yeah,
out of the shadows with this jacket, you know, it looked like something out of The Shadow, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, and he goes over and he's yanking on the door. And he's yelling at the top of it, and now it's raining like crazy.
Yeah.
And he goes, open up, open up, open up. Now I could see the reflection because the light was coming through,
sure,
their car.
Mm-hmm.
And because lights, you know, from the, and I could see the silhouettes. And here's all these people, everyone in the car, and there was about 4 or 5 people in the car, moved over to the driver's side,
yeah,
and we're all facing this way. And here's this guy yanking, I mean, yanking on the door saying, open up! Like, because what would you think if you were waiting for this idiot, Bill Wish, who's supposed to pick him up, and it's raining like hell, so why wouldn't you open up the car? Why do you have it locked, you know?
Yeah.
So it was, and he's pounding on the door, and these people are freaked out. Their arms are up and everything, like,
yeah.
And then finally the light changed, and they took off. And then I drove up, and I said, Tony, I'm over here. Without any big deal, he just came walking over, got in the car, opened up the door, got in, wet, of course he was wet by this time, and he just sat there and said, And then we didn't say too much because I had to drive and get through the light and everything. And then he said, he looked or turned over and he said, I thought you were crazy. He says, I thought you were crazy. And he laughed because he knew it was a, but can you, my point with this story, and you have to read it in Amitai's book, but my point is, can you imagine what those people, knowing what Slidini looks like?
Sure.
With a hat on and his coat up to here, buttoned up to his
pouring
chin,
down rain like that, yeah.
Pouring rain, and this guy, a man that looks like studying his bank, an old man too, at that time he was probably about 75, 76, 77, and yanking and open up like he belonged in the car, yeah. Like, I deserve to be, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
These people, hopefully they, I think it was an out-of-town, I think, if I remember, it was an out-of-town license plate. So they must have freaked out, and they probably never came back
they
to
New York. They probably came back to the city again.
Never again. They would never come back. They're crazy over there. These guys attack your car and everything, and they really look like they deserve to be in the car. That's how it is. They attack the car. It was just a funny story. You had to be there. It was just hilarious.
Well, so again, this just to wrap up things.
Sure.
That this lecture tour we're on now.
Yeah.
Is kind of a reprise of one that you had back in the 70s. Do you find that you are finding a whole new audience for people who are enjoying Slidini, who maybe had heard of him but haven't seen him, opposed to back in the 70s, that he was still kind of fresh and it's like, you know, we can't really get Slidini out of New York to lecture, but we can get you. And so now, since he's gone, that you're the last vestige of someone who is as close as they can get. So my point is, I guess, are you seeing a lot of young people who are really enjoying your lecture rather than just all the old guys coming out saying, oh, I remember and telling you their Slidini story.
Well, you get a lot of those too.
Yeah.
You get a lot of those too. It's great. Sometimes I get his stories. I want to write them down.
But like me showing you those pictures with the two
Absolutely.
Of us.
Everybody has those. There's always a few people at each lecture that come up and say, oh, I met Tony here and I met Tony there. And I find that fascinating, you know. And I just love to hear those stories. And it's an, but the real cool part to answer your question is there are a lot of young people, and they come up and say, hey, I really appreciate for the first time what this man did. And I said, well, you never really, I'm not going to give you the same, you know, you have to go. I send them to the cabinet tapes and look, but because I have a lot, nothing but respect for, I learned a lesson when I went around in the 70s, the first time I went around, the first few lectures, you know, it always takes you four or five to get smooth and the first few, I remember, and people would come out to see this guy. Who's Bill Wish? You know, who's this guy trying to be Slidini? So I finally realized after 2 months, the first thing I have to do as soon as I get out there is say, hey, folks, if you're here to see Slidini tonight, I apologize. You're not going to see Slidini tonight. So I would right away break the ice and kind of get rid of that. And they would kind of say, oh, okay, at least he's being honest, you know.
Yeah.
But he was the magic. He was the real magic. I can't tell you if you didn't know him, you met him. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't know him, you don't know what charisma is until you met either him or Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
Charisma is an unbelievable thing. You can't describe. It's an intangible. But he had it.
It's an aura.
One time, Derek Dingell and he was, both of them were hired by this one doctor in New York City for a bar mitzvah, and he got the biggest. Because he got a kick out of Derek Dingell, because Derek, a great magician, was one of my favorites. But Derek Dingell came to him one time in the studio and said, I'd like you to make me a stage act. And he told me the story. Tony said, you know, Derek Dingell, he comes here, he says to me, I want you to make me a stage act. And Slidini said, are you kidding? He laughed. He said, well, just like that? You want me? He said, yeah. So, you know, he thought Slidini would give him put together a stage act. Because he did help a lot of people, obviously. You know, Neil owes tons of people. But no, he never did learn a stage act. But he got the biggest kick out of the fact that he would come and ask him for it. But the funny thing about it is they did this party. Like I said, it was bar mitzvah. And, you know, he was down at one end of the room. But, you know, Derek Dingell was down at one end of the room and Slidini was at the other end of the room entertaining while this thing was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said, he got the biggest kick out of it. And, that there were maybe four or five people down with Derek and about 50 or 60 watching Slidini the whole day. So he got a kick out of that. He never really put people down, but he was very proud of the fact that he always used to say, never build yourself up, always let them build you up.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very biblical, actually. It's from the Bible. Don't build yourself up. Let people build you up. Now, you see so many magicians out there that they talk about how great they are. You know, tell everybody how wonderful they are. And it's tempting because it is. Sure. Magic's the only art that's based on mystery. So you can get it's a double-edged thing because you, number one, you're always going to get credit for stuff you can't do because mm-hmm. they don't know how it's done. But you're never going to get credit for all the work you put in. You know, so it's a double-edged
thing. Well, there was something you said this evening in the lecture as well that was one of Slidini's quotes. Something about mm-hmm. magic is something that people will never see.
Well, you're right. We're close. He used to say that. He didn't really like flourishes. And he said, whenever you do a flourish, or when he meant something to do, anything to do that showed off your skill,
mm-hmm.
he said, if you show off your skill, it's going to equally depress the magic. It's going to take away the magic effect. And at first, I didn't believe him. You know, I'm like any other person. Oh, I'm going to do it my way. People like flourishes. You know, they convince themselves. They like flourishes. I agree with Slidini. After all the years, I've been in 41 years now. I agree with him. People don't like flourishes. They watch them, and they're amazed by them. But I don't think they like them as much as magicians think they do.
Yeah.
I think they would rather see a really good trick. Or a mystification kind of thing, as opposed to watching cards spin around and stuff, which, of course, you can do, and it's great. I find that those things are, and he used to say this, those things are easy to practice. And they're hard, don't get me wrong, you can spend years practicing some of these flourishes, but they're easy to practice because you can't get caught with a flourish.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to do it, and then that's it. People, and you go to some of these people, these young people nowadays that do the flourishes, a lot of the triple and quadruple this, that, and the other things, and you say, can you do a double lift? And they go, what's that? Swear, and it's amazing. These guys are good with the cards.
Yeah.
They don't know what a double lift is. And can you show me a trick? And they say, I don't do tricks.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me.
It's just juggling, hand juggling.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was his point. He wanted to be a magician, and Vernon too, obviously you know about him with the naturalness and all.
Mm-hmm.
But Slidini used to say this line, and that was the line I went home and wrote it down. It was one of those lines. He said, magic is always something they don't see. He never said to people. He said, magic is always something they don't see. I remember it was seven words.
Seven words.
Magic is always something they don't see. And if you think about it, if they see anything that looks even the slightest bit like a skill, it takes away from the magic, if you think about it.
Sure. I've had people say, oh, well, you know, don't trust him. He's got fast hands or whatever.
And, you know, that's, and a lot of people, and I don't blame them. I can understand that. It's fun. And I'm kind of a little bit like that, too, in a way, or I used to be, where you know, it's fun. That's half the fun is showing off a little bit. You know, you see the guys in the, you know, the sting, you know, when the guy's doing in the movie with the, you know, the cards.
Oh, yeah.
All that's, you know, there's a certain amount of enjoyment watching these guys who can handle a deck of cards or do mm-hmm. coin things and stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. But if it comes to magic, it's going to take away. And he's right. I got to give slightly. And you know, one time he went to Europe, he told me for 6 months he didn't do one trick.
Really?
He went over there by himself
and
toured Europe, just going around talking to people, probably mostly Italy.
He wasn't lecturing or anything?
He wasn't lecturing, didn't even do one trick for 6 months. He said he just had to get away from it. And so he did a lot of thinking about it. And on the train. So, you know, on the train you could think.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him saying it. You got to really, if you want to be a magician, you have to act like a magician, and you have to really do magic. And he said the only way you're going to do magic is if you believe it. If you believe it's magic, they'll believe it's magic. And he said, and if you do anything with skill, even a one-handed cut or something like that, as soon mm-hmm. as they see that, they give you credit for being able to do the, rather than the, but if you just handle them, he said, not clumsily, but handle them just like anybody would, like nicely, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Then it's more like magic.
Oh, my God, when you do something. Sure. That's why when he would do some of his routines, like the helicopter card, and people say, well, how did he do them? Well, because they didn't think of him as a magician. They thought of him as a technician. They thought of him as a magician.
Yeah, big difference.
And, yeah, I think that's the one thing I think that I would say he has Vernon. Vernon was more known for the technical part, which is nice. Of course, his big thing was that
natural.
He was so natural.
Sure.
Everything he did was natural, so you can get away with, and that's its own little thing. But even Vernon, I think, at times probably got, you know, maybe a little less of the magic part of it. As opposed to this, he would get a little more skill oriented, which I don't think he minded.
Mm-hmm.
But Slidini, I saw Slidini work. I could tell you so many times he performed that only lay people were there, and parties too. Only lay people, him and I, because so many of them, and he would just floor people with his magic. Lay people, floor them. more so than even magicians, because they had no clue. They didn't know he was lapping anything.
Sure.
I mean, magicians know that he's lapping and they still fool him, and that's part of the charm. They say, it's amazing, he can show you how to do this, and then he still fools you with it. But he would freak people out. There was one party I went to, one of his students, who was another student, and he lived in a really nice place in the Palisades overlooking New York City, and he had this beautiful apartment, and he invited Slidini to come and perform. And he was a member of a acting group. And you know how acting groups are. Local acting group. So a lot of these people were like frustrated big time actors. They weren't big names or anything, but they were pretty good. They could act, you know, but they had the ego. And I remember myself sitting there, and of course this fellow knew how to set up the room. He knew what kind of table, so he made sure he had everything. And so I remember as soon as this little Italian guy showed up, all these people were kind of, who's he? Who's he? Oh, wow. What's this? He's the entertainment? Oh, wow. And they were kind of making fun of him a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, they said, what is this? You know, this ought to be good. Or, you know, that kind of thing. And I heard these comments because they didn't know I was involved with him. And I really wasn't. He invited me just to come and watch. After about 3 hours of performing, these people were ready to carry him out to the car on their backs, on their shoulders. He did everything you can imagine. And these were really egotistical people.
Yeah.
You could sense they were real snobs because they were actors, you know.
And he had turned them completely.
He just wasted these people. And yeah. I always remembered that one show because my wife was there too. And I remember looking at her saying, man, that guy is amazing. And there's magician. I saw most of the guys in the 70s and 80s. And I met a lot of them on the tour. Met a lot of the guys that I would never have seen. He was unbelievable.
Now, we talked about Di Vernon a little bit, and that Di lived out in New York and was called the New York card expert. And then he and Tony were friends, I guess,
yep.
back then. And that was probably way back then when Vernon was still doing his Harlequin act, I guess, maybe when he...
Harlequin act, and also that's when they did Stars of Magic, too.
Yeah.
They were both in New York City.
Both did that. And then he moved that, of course, out to California where he... finished out his life, but I've heard some stories where that they really didn't get along. Then I've heard other stories saying no, that they were friends.
Yep, they were friends.
What? Yeah.
Never. He told me, he said, we get along fine, and whenever they saw each other, they had plenty of fun, plenty of time. They'd spend time together, and they would argue little arguments. You know, like for one, there's one story about him and Vernon both going at it together, and they were in the same room. And Slidini would say, Vernon would say, that's over there. You put it over there, and he'd say, not there or here. You put it here if it's close up, and you put it there if it's far away. And Slidini would say, no, you put it there, and you put it, you know, and they were going back and forth, arguing
yeah.
back and forth, fun, you know, and it was
over
just,
semantics,
it was just funny, you know, it's,
yeah.
That I've heard stories like that, but they always got along. And the only thing that I think I asked him once, I said, "This is a silly question, Tony." And I said, I used to call him Tony. A lot of guys would call him Slidini or Mr. Slidini, but I called him Tony, and he called me William. So that was cute. The only person in the world to call me William. He liked that name. So, but I asked him once. I said, "Who do you think is better, you or Di Vernon? Because you're obviously both icons."
Yeah.
And he looked at me and says, "Look, I'm going to leave it out of you up to you, but I could tell you this," he says, "Di Vernon's a wife who loves of my magic." She says it to me, "You're the only magician I like her to watch." That's all he would say.
That's good. That's
which
good.
I thought was kind of charming, you know, but he was a great guy, and he never built himself up. He didn't have to.
Well, let me just finish then with asking you my final question. That the name of this podcast is called The Magic Word. And you've given us a lot of words and a lot of things that have to do with Slidini, and I'd like to know something about Bill Wish then also, about what would be your magic word. What is it that you live by? What is your credo?
Oh, here's an interesting... It was funny you mentioned that, because a while back, I was doing a trick, and it was kind of... I thought about something, doing something in reverse.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I wonder if anybody's ever done this. So I wrote out the word abracadabra, and then I wrote it out backwards. Arba da Carba. And if you look it up, if you write out abracadabra and then write right below it, just write it backwards. Take each letter and just, you know,
sure.
reverse it. And read it. It says Arba, A-R-B-A-D-A-C-A-R-B-A, Arba da Carba. So I used that for years. Whenever I wanted to do a reverse, if I was doing a coin production and I'd make it vanish, and I'd have the people say Arbiter Carbons, and I had even a hat with Arbiter Carbon written on it. So talk about magic words. And I think so-and-so, somebody had a book out that they put out a book about 10 years ago about different things and magic words and stuff. I forget who it was. It's online, and that's in there. But Arbiter Carbon. But the magic word is, I had a presentation I used to do for salespeople called the word, the magic word is showmanship. And it was five elements. I did research on Barnum and Cohan, George M. Cohan, and Houdini, of course, Muhammad Ali, all these great showmen. Mm-hmm. And there were five elements that these showmen, I did a lot of research because I wanted to find out what made these people such great showmen. Because one person said to me once, they reviewed my act, and they said, he's got a lot of skill, but he lacks showmanship. So after I picked up my ego and dusted it off, you know, I said to them, at that time I was still a young man, and I said, you know, I'm not going to let this dissuade me. I want to find out what showmanship is, and I'm going to work on that, you know. So I looked it up in the dictionary, and it said, see show. You know, and the only thing that had something about horses, you know, showmanship.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have much about showmanship. It just had see the word show. So you look up the word show, and it had all these definitions of different verbs, sure, and adjectives. So I said, there is no definition for showmanship. Okay. So then at that time I was working with a company, you know, I just happened to ask a lot of people in marketing. I said, what is showmanship? And they said, well, it's pizzazz, or it's, you know, an excitement. Or I said, no, but what is it that causes the pizzazz? What is it that makes the excitement? Not just, you know, the results. What is it that causes it? I don't know. So that's when I started researching these guys. And I found out there were five elements that they used. And
what are
they
those?
Didn't even realize it. Mystery, action, gratification, involvement, and challenge. Every one of them used these five elements to spice up their presentation or whatever it was that they were selling, and they didn't even realize it. They didn't have all these, you know, rehashed programs that we have today on salesmanship or showmanship or how to add selling, you know, selling techniques. But they did it automatically. And if you study Barnum's life and if you study George M. Cohen, you'll see a lot of those elements. And so what I did
was just part of their personality.
Personality, exactly. Yeah. So my point was, if I can go to these corporations and tell this and do a presentation, and I used to dress up as Barnum. I had the old coat and the whole bit. And he was a magician, an amateur magician, as a matter of fact. He loved magic. But I would go out and I had a whole 2-hour presentation scripted. I went to an acting coach and everything. And it was called The Magic, What's in It for Me. That's what it was called when I originally started. And then I eventually broke it out to, you know, the magic word of showmanship. But make a long story short, I would go out to the companies and say, look, you don't have to write anything down. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to read any books. You don't have to memorize anything. But some of you guys have been in the field for years. Some of you only been starting out. But I guarantee you, if you use one or more than one of these elements of showmanship, you will, and here's the definition. I came up with the definition myself. Here's the definition. The quality of performance and or display that creates and sustains dramatic interest. That's what showmanship is. If you're a baby and you're sitting in a crib and somebody's there and you're a little toddler and somebody's waving this rattle in front of your face, there is nothing that baby is looking at or thinking about more than that rattle, that little action thing.
Right, right.
If you can get your clients that interested in your presentation, or
and
if you
focused on just that.
Focused, absolutely, all about focused. And how do you do that? So many people, they try this, they try high pressure, they try low pressure, blah, blah, blah. Add mystery, action, gratification, involvement, or challenge, or one or more than those five elements. And if you put those five, and I would show each one, for example, I could give you the whole spiel, but action, for example, you can go to the boardwalk and watch a guy with a Vegematic. Remember the old Vegematic?
Sure.
Where you chop up the vegetables?
Slices,
and
nice.
You know, and of course they had the guy on TV now with the thing where he throw the, you know, the ShimWow and all this stuff, same kind of thing. Or you could have them stacked up and a guy sitting there reading a magazine. Who's going to sell more? Obviously, the guy who's demonstrating,
sure.
A demonstration is much more effective than an exhibit. So if you can figure out a way to just demonstrate something as part of your presentation, something that they're going to remember, maybe even a magic trick or a little trick or a little something, cute little thing, that's one way to add showmanship, get that focus. And they'd say, yeah, I never thought of that. And I'd say, that's just one. Mystery. People love mystery. You know, gratification. They love to have fun.
Get something.
Involvement, of course. Oh, my gosh. I studied Tom Hopkins. I knew Tom Hopkins real well. In fact, I got a chance to get to know him real well. But I studied his course in and out with Tom Hopkins, you know, the sales training.
Sure.
And that's what I used to talk about, sales questions and how they, you know, the open-ended questions. Anytime you make a statement, you're missing a point. You're losing an opportunity to get showmanship because that involvement is only going to be there when you ask a question. Questions are the answer. And then, of course, challenge. Of course, Houdini, I would use that. That's why there's never been another Houdini because nobody's had the guts to really challenge like he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what he did was a challenge, let's face it, to do some of the stuff.
In every city.
He didn't just go out there and he didn't have, you know, he had outs, but nobody knew it. But mm-hmm. Talk about a challenge. So if you take these five elements, and I would use examples, and I had this presentation for years with corporations, you know, and it went over well. If you put the five letters together, it's MAGIC, magic. Mystery, action, gratification, involvement, and challenge. And I said, if you remember those five letters, MAGIC, and memorize those five words, mystery, action, not necessarily when you're presenting whatever it is, your product or service, but when you're in front of the, if you can think about it, I said my recommendation is to go home, sit in a nice warm chair, close your eyes, and think, how can I add mystery? How can I add action? How can I, you know, into your product line or whatever it is, and make. And I've had a lot of good success with it. I had people. So one guy, one of the companies I did, I think it was Pfizer or one of the companies I did, sent in my definition, and now it's in the dictionary, Webster's Dictionary.
Well, I'll be.
So my definition for showmanship finally made the big time.
Well, that is a fantastic word and a great
story.
Explanation.
Great story. So. Didn't expect that. Right?
No.
I didn't either, to be honest. This is all rehearsed, folks. We've been up months putting this all together. You know?
All right. Well, that has been just a wonderful hour. I appreciate the stories that you've shared over here.
My pleasure.
And so for now, that's Bill Wish, and this is Scott Welch for The Magic Word. Scotty out.